Dr. Robert P. Jones, founder and CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, and personally a good friend. His brand new book is provocatively titled White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And I am so pleased that it brings the author back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, congratulations on this important new book and welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. I'm always thrilled to be back.
In this extremely important new book, as well as in the article published by NBCNews.com earlier this week, you make the case that white Christians have constructed and sustained a project of perpetuating white supremacy that has framed the entire American story. What's that based on?
Well, you know, this book, as you know, in my day job, I am the CEO at Public Religion Research Institute. So I think the first thing to say is that this book is based on a lot of data and a lot of data analysis of contemporary public opinions among white Christians, you know, that include not just white evangelicals, but also white mainline Protestants and white Catholics. You know, it really is grounded in the patterns that we can continue to see in the data today, especially when we ask questions that aren't just about like personal racism, but that are more questions about systemic racism and that really is the legacy of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. How do you define white supremacy and systemic racism?
Yeah. Well, you know, these are terms, I think, particularly white supremacy, that people attach a lot of different meanings to. And I take some pains in the book to unpack this. And, you know, I think the challenge is that when many, particularly white people, and I should say to your listeners who don't know, I am white and, you know, identify as Christian myself, and grew up Southern Baptist in Mississippi. So that's the world I come out of. But when you hear that word, I think many white Christians particularly hear this word, white supremacy, there's an initial dismissal that this has anything to do with us, right? That it's kind of narrowed down to only apply to extremist groups that wear, you know, sheets and are kind of carry out terrorist acts or, you know, are marching in the streets. You know, chanting, you know, neo-Nazi slogans. Like, but that's not what I mean at all in the book. That's the kind of the extreme edge and one kind of expression of it. But I mean something that's much broader, much more familiar, and much more insidious. And that is a kind of broader commitment to a society. To put it just in plain language. If you just flip the words around, you know, instead of white supremacy, that is dedicated to the supremacy of whites. And even if we unpack that a little further and just make sure we get it in really plain language, that is kind of backing a society that is set up to benefit the lives of white Americans in ways that and to limit the life prospects of non-white Americans. Mm-hmm. And if we, you know, there's no way of really reading American history all the way up, you know, to the late 20th century without realizing that, you know, from the beginning, you know, who was able to vote at the beginning, white male property owners, yeah. You know, and that our country has been, the history of our country, you know, I think is one of progress, but the thing that we have been struggling against throughout our entire history really has been, you know, this having a society that is really set up to value the lives of white Americans and to devalue the lives of non-white Americans. And that's what I mean by this legacy of white supremacy. And it's challenging because it is not quite as visible as overt racist comments, right? It lives within us. It lives in our institutions. And it takes some real effort, I think, for particularly for white Christians who've been raised in it. To even see it for what it is.
Sure. You provide readers with an index by which racism can be measured. It's a really important part of the book. What comprises your racism index?
Yeah. So, you know, I do want to say too many readers end up hearing data and their eyes glossing over that. I have kept the data really to one chapter in this book. It's meant for a broad audience. But I did want to ground it in a fairly rigorous set of public opinion data. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I do is create a broad range of measures that can measure attitudes toward not just kind of personal attitudes like do you feel warmly toward African Americans, those kinds of questions, but are more about policy and structural issues. So I'll give you a couple of examples. And the main reason I do this is because, you know, you can't, in a public opinion survey, you certainly can't directly ask people, you know, do you consider yourself racist or a white supremacist? Or you could ask those questions, but they wouldn't be very productive. Mm-hmm. So trying to get a more accurate view was what I was up to. So I a couple of examples here, you know, one that's right out of the headlines, really, is we have a question where we asked, and these all come from PRRI surveys that are kind of national random probability surveys, but we asked about whether the killing of unarmed black men by police, for example, is part of a broader pattern of how police treat African Americans, or do you see them as isolated incidents? And on that question, for example, white Christians are nearly twice as likely as whites who are religiously unaffiliated to say that these are isolated incidents. In other words, they have a hard time seeing the patterns there. When we asked about whether the Confederate flag, for example, is more a symbol of Southern pride or more a symbol of racism, white Christians are at least 30 points more likely than religiously unaffiliated whites to say that it is a symbol of Southern pride rather than a symbol of racism. So I had a number of questions like that that were intended to get a broader measure of racist attitudes. There are 15 questions at all in this, and I called it a racism index. And then I combined these into one composite variable to really measure this. And the bottom line is that even when you look across a broad set of questions, the pattern is just very, very clear.
Yeah.
That white Christians, and again, I'm not just talking about white evangelicals in the South, you know, this world that you and I sort of, right. you know, grew up in and came out of, but white mainline Protestants that are more prevalent in the Midwest, and even white Catholics that are more prevalent in more urban centers in the Northeast, all score significantly higher on this racism index than do whites who have no religious affiliation and or other non-white Americans. So that pattern was just so shockingly and really appallingly, I should say, clear in the data of opinions today.
How does Christian affiliation compare with people's geographical locations and cultural traits?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things you have to be careful about in this kind of statistical analysis is trying to figure out, you know, once you see a correlation that I've just laid out between holding more racist views and particularly structurally racist views and identifying as a white Christian, you have to ask the second question. It's like, okay, well, that correlation is there. But are there other variables that might explain it? Like perhaps it's because white Christians tend to live in regions that are more culturally conservative or former states of the Confederacy, so it's geography really, or that they are more likely to identify as Republican. So really it's maybe it's partisanship that's controlling this, or it's education level. So what I did in the analysis for the book is actually took that correlation and then put it into a more sophisticated statistical model that could actually test for all these intervening variables, so it would hold all these other variables constant, and so that you could then see whether this correlation that you initially see in the data is actually an independent correlation and connection there. And it turns out that sure enough, even controlling for all of these other potentially confounding factors, this holding more racist attitudes is positively and independently connected with a greater likelihood of identifying as a white Christian. So that's there. And then, you know, when you ask yourself the question, you're like, okay, it's there. Now let's go back. Why is that there? And then I think, you know, the history comes in. I spent a fair amount of time kind of unpacking just institutional history, unpacking kind of theological history to really help explain how this could be. Because I do think the response from many, you know, well-meaning and good-hearted white Christians to seeing that data is shock. And to say, well, you know, the question is, well, how can this be? But when you really take a harder look at the way that the theology is developed and the way that in its historical context in this country, really the question becomes, well, how could it be otherwise?
Mm-hmm. You wisely anticipated an argument that surely people who attend church are not as racist as those who don't. You silence that thought and assert that just the opposite is the truth. Racist views are stronger among regularly church-going people who are white Christians than less frequent church attenders. Now, why is that? Does the racism in Christian congregations stem from the teaching and preaching in a church or from a church's silence about racism and emphasis on social justice, or is it something else?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, one of the other things, tires that I wanted to kick and just make sure I wasn't missing something there, is to figure out what role attendance, because there is this argument, okay, well, this data you just described is really only implicating people who claim to be Christian, right? People who are Christian in name only, is the phrase that's often used. So I really did want to see whether higher attendance, you know, made a difference here. And among white Christians as a whole, as you said, it makes no difference. Both low attending and high attending white Christians as a whole score actually higher on this racism index than do those who attend, those who don't identify as white Christian. And among white evangelicals, actually, it's actually worse. Not only does attendance not mitigate holding more racist attitudes, but in the white evangelical subgroup, it turns out that the more you attend, the more likely you are to hold these racist attitudes. It actually has the opposite effect of mitigating mitigating those views. So I think it's a number of things. You know, I think it is certainly. I guess the challenge has been that, you know, white Christian churches historically have, you know, I put it in the book, I mean, have, you know, on the issue of racial equality, have committed sins of commission and sins of omission, both. So I think it is both an active way that the theology has been constructed. And just one example I give, you know, in the book is the way that that white, particularly evangelical theology, has been constructed to be about a personal relationship with Jesus, right? And how this hyper-individualistic way of understanding what salvation means and really what the core of the Christian life means has the effect of screening out questions of social justice and questions of social equality from what it means to be properly Christian, right? So as long as you have this kind of inner connection, inner and individual connection with Jesus and a kind of piety, that's the beginning and the end of Christianity and that understanding. And I think that's been one piece of it. And it has been one of the ways that the white churches have really maintained a white supremacist status quo in society, both inside and outside the congregation, is through a kind of silence. But when you already have a society that's structured to value the lives of white people over others, silence is a tool for perpetuating that unjust status quo. And that's something I think white Christian churches have really perfected, is this silence in the midst of great inequality. It was one of the things that, you know, Martin Luther King in Letter from Birmingham Jail lamented, right, is he was looking out not over the kind of most racist folks, but he was looking out over the moderates, right? The kind of respectable white moderate churches. And he asked this question, so who are these people? You know, what kind of gospel is preached here? How do they sit behind their anesthetizing stained glass windows? And I think that's a pretty accurate description of the way that white churches and white Christian theology have functioned at such mm-hmm. critical moments in our country's life.
Mm-hmm. Robbie, is a person who carries racist attitudes toward African Americans more likely to also being anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and biased toward people who live in other parts of the country? I have known a lot of people who were as hate-oriented toward Yankees as they were toward African Americans.
Well, I don't know about the Yankee part, although I have lived in the South most of my life, so you know I have certainly heard my share of carpetbagger comments. But you know what I would say is this: is I think that's the thing about really understanding white supremacy. And again, even in its extremist form, it's worth remembering, right, that the KKK was not just anti-black, it was anti-Jewish and it was anti-Catholic, mm-hmm. right? Even in that extremist formation. But, you know, even if we take it from the extreme to the halls of respectability among mainline Protestants, for example, you know, in the 1940s, the Christian Century, which was, you know, the flagship magazine of the kind of respectable liberal Protestant elite, spent more than a dozen issues talking about the Catholic threat to America and to American democracy. I mean, a very anti-Catholic, you know, sentiment that was, you know, as late as the 1940s, occupying the, you know, dominating really the pages of that magazine, and that's on the liberal end of the white Protestant world. But if you think about, you know, this sense, it is a kind of valuing, and typically it has been the valuing of white Protestant lives over others, so white Christian, but particularly white Protestant lives in its historical, you know, manifestations. I mean, FDR, you know, who also seen as often a fairly progressive president, infamously said, you know, this is a Protestant country, and everyone else is here by sufferance. So this idea of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you know, WASPy country, and that is what America is and what America should be. That's the core of what I mean when I'm talking about white supremacy, mm-hmm. and the thing that I think we've got to, you know, purge from our psyches and our religion and our politics.
I am fully aware that any discussion like this is going to make many people feel defensive and angry.
Yeah.
But you come at this from a data-driven perspective, not ideology or partisanship. Still, we live in an age when people are incredibly ready to hear only what they want to hear. So how can we discuss this sensitive subject without the conversation being dismissed outright? Why is it very much in the interest of the very people you describe as benefiting from white supremacy to carefully consider the points that you're making?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I should say to that question is, you know, I worked very hard in the book to make this book a personal book, mm-hmm. And to talk about my own journey on many of these questions. And so, you know, the first sentence in the book has the word I in it. The last sentence in the book has the word us. Mm-hmm. In it, and I talk about we white Christians, you know, throughout the book, and talk a lot about my own family story. So it's been a journey for me too, and I do think maybe perhaps the biggest thing in the way of having really a more mature and honest conversation is this myth of innocence that we have so carefully built. I mean, we white Christians, you know, we have these narratives where we are the pillars of society, everything good about America, you know, has come really from us. And I think that's a really, I think, childish and naive way, you know, of understanding who we are and our history. And, you know, at the end of the book, I talk about the fact that, look, there's really important justice work to be done here. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only reason white Christians should be invested in this work. This is not really, I'm not calling, you know, primarily for a work of altruism on the part of white Christians. White Christians have a lot at stake here. I mean, if for example, you care about whether the faith that we have inherited from previous generations, you know, is authentic and whether it really represents you know, the best of Christianity, we have to ask some very hard questions. You know, the faith of our fathers, as the hymn goes, you know, I mean, the job of all of us, I think, is to, you know, take what's valuable in that. But we also have to do the hard work of excising what's wrong, what we've been handed down that's wrong. And I think that work has there's been very little of that kind of work done among white Christians as a whole. But I think if we're willing to let go of this need to have this narrative of innocence, that we're willing to have this a great winnowing, really, of what can we hang on to? What's good and right? But where have we been appallingly wrong?
Yeah.
You know, and when we ask the question about race, the bulk of the white Christian churches, and I don't mean the symbolic ways that certain leaders are, even denominations have taken stands, but you know, you can see it in the public opinion data. And if you think about the great, you know, kind of bulk of people sitting in the pews, we've never really had a reckoning with our role in perpetuating and legitimizing this worldview that valued white lives over all others.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is founder and CEO of the invaluable Public Religion Research Institute, and he is the author now of two important books that apply scrupulous research and analysis to the most important trends shaping our nation. Robbie's latest, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, was published this past week by Simon & Schuster. Robbie, it's always great to talk with you, and thank you so much for taking this time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's been so great. Thanks so much for the conversation, and great to be with you again.